It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, at least 60% of a consumer's initial judgment of a product is based on what color it is. Think about the Home Depot orange, the Facebook blue. Well, it turns out companies can actually own those colors. We'll find out how coming up. First, we recently received a listener question from our new Why Sconson project. This comes from Dave Van in Madison. Here's a listen.
Why is it so hard to get people to be excited or interested in joining the police force in Madison? Because there appears to be a stark lack of them. You know, with the rash of vandalism and car thefts in Madison lately, I feel like people have been concerned about the feeling of public safety. And to top that all off, I think there's just been this growing sense of resentment nationally towards the police.
We wanted to tackle the issue of police recruitment, and we started right at the source of that question. Earlier today, we talked to Madison Police Department's acting chief, Victor Wall. Chief Wall, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we had a listener ask us about police recruiting. He started by saying that he perceives a lack of police presence around Madison. Can you talk about the current size of the department and how that translates to visibility?
Well, they're kind of two separate issues a little bit. In terms of recruitment, that speaks to what sort of applicant pool we're attracting, but not necessarily our authorized strength. Our authorized strength these days is 483 sworn officers this year. We've been making the case for a number of years, and I will continue to make the case that as the city grows in population and geographically, and as our workload grows daily, our staffing needs to keep up with that if we want to continue to provide the kind of service that our community expects. And I think we're falling a little bit behind, and I think one of the ways that manifests itself is through visibility, because our officers have less and less free time to just do patrol or get out on foot and walk through neighborhoods, because they're spending all their time on calls and incidents, and they just don't have that flexibility that we'd like them to have.
Getting to the recruiting side of things, I've heard for other departments around the state and the country, they're reporting having trouble, you know, they're not getting the numbers of recruits or applicants that they used to. What are you seeing in Madison?
Well, we definitely have not been immune to that, and we have definitely seen the number of applicants that we're receiving decline. In fact, if you compare the last few years during our hiring processes, what we've seen, it's about a third of what we were seeing 10 years ago. So we're not immune to that, and certainly that's a national trend. I think the good news as far as we're concerned is that even though we're getting smaller pools, we're still getting large enough pools where we have qualified applicants and good people that we feel real confident about hiring and training and bringing on to the department. Certainly there's places in the country and departments where they can't even attract qualified applicants to fill their vacancies, and we're a long ways from that, but certainly the larger pool of applicants we have, I think, the better. So I would like to see us reverse that trend, or at least sort of try to inch things back in the direction that they were.
What do you see as some of the reasons that might lead to that smaller applicant pool?
Well, I think it's a little bit complicated. I think certainly the national narrative on policing over the last, 5 years or so has been largely negative, and I think that impacts people. I think sort of the heightened scrutiny that police officers are coming under these days makes it a challenge, and I think there's people that don't want that sort of stress, don't want to be concerned about being on the front page of the newspaper or being sort of the next, YouTube social media sensation for doing their job. I think that's a piece of it. Certainly one thing that has always, I think, impacted police hiring, and it's kind of cyclical, is just how the rest of the economy is doing, and certainly we've had a pretty strong economy tying along this narrative over the last 5 years, and that gives people a lot of other opportunities for employment. And I think, those to me seem like the two major drivers that are affecting us here locally and the rest of the field nationally.
If you were talking to a younger person thinking about their career options, what would you say to them to encourage at least considering a career as a police officer?
Well, I would say, this is a job where not only can you make a difference, but you will make a difference. We just had a retirement celebration last week where I was speaking to probably about 300 years of collective experience for a number of our retirees, and really highlighting to them that they'll probably never even have a good comprehension of how many lives they positively impacted during their career. Certainly the big calls, the big incidents will stick out in our minds, but you know, it's easy to forget that a routine encounter for us is not necessarily routine to the community member we're dealing with. And to be able to have those positive impacts over the course of your career, to literally save lives and to literally be able to improve your community, is something that not a lot of jobs offer those opportunities. And so I think, you know, we're looking for people that really have a calling to serve and want to make those differences and have an impact. And, you know, it's an opportunity that policing provides.
Chief Wall, thanks a lot for taking the time today.
Happy to.
That was Acting Chief of the Madison Police Department, Victor Wall. To continue the conversation, we wanted to talk more about policing and recruitment around the state. Jim Palmer is in the studio, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Calvin Barrett is also in the studio with us, law enforcement instructor at Madison College. Calvin, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thank you for having me.
Jim, let's start with you. Are we seeing this around the state? Are we having a problem finding enough applicants for these police department jobs?
You know, we are. As the state's largest law enforcement group, we represent the vast majority of officers in the state. And so I have the opportunity to travel around and interact with our officers on a statewide basis. And one of the things I hear most consistently is that agencies are having a difficult time getting a sufficient number of applicants, where, you know, much like Chief Wall just described, you know, they used to get several hundred, you know, applicants for one position. Now they're lucky if they can get, you know, one applicant for one vacancy.
And Calvin, we'll get into some of the negatives in a bit, but you work with people who have already made the decision to pursue a career in law enforcement. What are the positives you hear from them about why they want to pursue this as a career?
They see it just like everyone else, and like what Chief Wall discussed, as an opportunity for a positive change and a positive implementation of a good perspective of law enforcement and the ability to make a positive change in people's lives from a day-to-day basis. And that's really one of the best things. That wearing a badge and being a law enforcement officer is something that is one of the greatest things. I wear a badge currently now, and it's something that we all look forward to, and we all wake up every morning excited for the opportunity to be that positive role model in everyone's lives.
Now, there's a lot of competition out there. It's a tight labor market. Do you see that affecting people's decisions maybe to go through this program or not?
Yes. There, I mean, it's always competition is good, but I think if people have the right motives and the right ideas and their heart is in the right place. Our motto at Madison College is, if you were doing things the right way and for the right reasons, great things will come. And I think once we take that approach and we get, you know, applicants in that are doing that, things go in the right direction.
Jim, do you see departments doing things differently to try to reach out to more people, maybe people who wouldn't have thought of this as a career in the past?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in particular, more and more agencies in Wisconsin, and you know, this is happening in Wisconsin more than I see in other states, is they're using social media in order to try and reach out to this, you know, younger millennial demographic. There's also, you know, our local unions that are affiliated with us, working with their agencies to, you know, kind of take care of some of the quality of life issues. You know, like, you know, are there things we can do to experiment with 10 or 12 hour shifts so officers are getting more time away from the job? And, you know, more and more agencies throughout the, not only Wisconsin, but throughout the country are, you know, relaxing their policies that prohibit things like beards and tattoos. And, you know, it might sound kind of silly, but, you know, even Scotland Yard and the Air Force have been, you know, eliminating those practices. So it clearly it's, you know, there's an effort, a concerted effort, to reach out to a younger demographic and bring them into this profession and into this calling.
I hear in a lot of lines of work these days, everything from farming to skilled work, all kinds of things. Baby boomers are leaving the workforce. Is that part of the story here in police departments?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, baby boomers and you know, officers obviously retire at an earlier age than a lot of other employees because, you know, there are public policy reasons for that, of course. You know, younger people today entering the job market, they have a lot of other choices, career options available to them that are less dangerous, that don't, you know, aren't confronted with the same degree of public scrutiny. And obviously they can probably pay more money as well. So no one enters the profession, I think, to become rich. They do it really because, as Calvin said, it's a calling and it's something that they are genuinely committed to.
And Calvin, that public scrutiny issue, do you hear from your students that you're working with that they're worried about what they see in the news as far as how police officers are portrayed?
Yes, that's one of the main concerns, especially with our younger officers that are coming through. The scrutiny is something that is on the back of everyone's mind, especially with social media and the media really sticking to a lot of the negative incidents that involve law enforcement. I see this too in the academy, where students are really looking for more of a right or wrong or a black or white type response to a handful of situations. And we tell them in law enforcement, there's really not that. There's a lot of gray area that deals with articulation and what you felt and what you saw at that moment, which really dictates right from wrong.
Now, police work does get oversight, and I think a lot of people would agree that it needs some kind of oversight. How do you thread the needle, Jim, between appropriate oversight from a police and fire commission and from the public and the media versus overweening public scrutiny?
Well, I think transparency and accountability for law enforcement is very important. I mean, it's of paramount importance for officers in order to do their jobs and be safe doing those jobs to maintain the trust and credibility of the public. And, having effective accountability measures like we do here in Wisconsin, we have a police and fire commissions. They've existed in this state for over 100 years, and we're one of the few, I think one of 20 states that has such a oversight model, civilian oversight model. So it's very, very important, and it protects officers and kind of balances the interests of the public and those that must have to serve them.
We're talking to Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and Calvin Barrett, a law enforcement instructor at Madison College. We're talking about recruitment and retention of officers in Madison and around Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in law enforcement yourself, or are you retired? What do you think about public perception of the job? Do you see people going into it? What would you tell them about that decision to go into police work as a member of the public? What do you think? What do you see in your local police department? Do you want more visibility in your part of the state? What questions do you have for our guests who work on these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up on a conversation about police recruiting, retention, and public perception. This comes from a Wisconsin question from a listener. Earlier, we talked to Madison Police Department's Acting Chief Victor Wall. Our guests now are Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and Calvin Barrett, who teaches law enforcement at Madison College. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how the public views and scrutinizes police officers? Do you have a question about what it's like to work in law enforcement and the training that goes into it? Do you now, or have you ever worked in law enforcement yourself? Love to hear your perspective on this conversation. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jim, I know we've talked to you in the past about efforts you've made with, in some cases, unlikely partners to try to bridge the gap between communities and police departments. Is that part of the story? Do we need more of that to kind of change the perception that people have of the police?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, as you know, we're actually just about to go to the, into the field with our 8th annual poll, statewide poll that we conduct with the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Center. And, we gauge the public's opinion on a wide variety of criminal justice and law enforcement related topics. We want to gauge their perception, how they feel about, officers and the jobs that they're doing, and what law enforcement's priorities ought to be. And then we use that as a foundation to kind of go around the state and engage in a dialogue. And, we've really found that to be, hugely beneficial for us as an organization, the only state law enforcement group in the country that does this. But it gives us the ability to play a more proactive role in driving, the discourse, the public discourse. And I think more of that is critically needed, and there needs to be a greater dialogue.
And Calvin, I understand you're in Madison at Madison College, but you don't just work with people training to be police officers in Madison. Right. What do you hear from people around the state in different kinds of communities about how they think of police work?
Well, we at Madison College see people from all over, from different counties, surrounding counties, as well as all over the southern part of the state. And the overall consensus is that, you know, it's a great field to be in. It's a great field that they want to come in, and it's an opportunity to make change and do great things. But their only hesitation a lot of times comes in whether or not they have a specific police type background. And what we want everyone to know is that you do not specifically need a police background. You don't need a criminal justice degree in order to do that. We accept and train people from all walks that start with, you know, that range from stay-at-home fathers all the way up to teachers, to social workers, to mathematicians, whatever that is. We just want good quality, hardworking people, and that's what we're looking to train and hire.
Let's bring on a caller now. Dan is with us in Monona. Dan, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, it was just my dad always used to say how police used to be your friend, and like it changed that now when you look in your rearview mirror, you cringe like you're going to be in trouble. You check to see if you're doing anything wrong. And, you know, if anything, I hope you don't lower standards to get more police. If you, anything, I think the psychology tests or anything need to be tougher.
Dan, thanks for the call. So a couple points there. First, that the perception we're only going to encounter a police officer if we're doing something wrong. I know you've got surveys, and a lot of the surveys show a lot of people feel very positively about the police, Jim. But is that out there, that perception like, uh-oh?
I think it is. I mean, you know, law enforcement's a unique profession in that an officer can do something that is, you know, really questionable or, you know, blatantly wrong in California. And you know, it somehow, to some extent, is attributed to an officer here in Madison or anywhere in Wisconsin. There are a few professions that you know, have to endure that kind of thing. You know, with regard to Dan's question or comment about lowering standards, that is something we're seeing in other states. You know, they're lowering standards, making it easier for officers, for people to become officers. And that's something that, you know, we feel strongly, against. We just don't, we want to maintain the high level of standards and do what we can to draw more people into the profession. And that's why, you know, Madison College and their efforts to kind of reach out to younger people, even at the high school level, is so critically important to, you know, get people interested at an earlier age.
Thanks for that call, Dan. And Calvin, I wanted to ask before we go back to callers, I think in the past, people think of themselves as police officers. They might do it if they're men. Do you see things opening up more and more over the years for women interested in policing?
Absolutely. We welcome it, and that is something that it's a perspective that we really haven't seen in the history of law enforcement is the perspective of a woman. And that's something that we encourage and that we want and that we are starting to see the numbers, especially in our academy, start to rise. I mean, it's not as even as 50-50, but we are definitely starting to see more women be interested in the field because they do bring a unique perspective to law enforcement, which is something that might not have had the voice in the past.
Let's go to another caller now. Jennifer is with us in Appleton. Jennifer, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I respect police officers a lot. My father was a police officer. The only problem I have around where I live is the city of Appleton is actually split by another police office. And the one that is involved mostly with car accidents that I have been into, and the recent one that I had, was basically the officer really didn't take my statement. He actually sided with the other man. I was crying because of what he was doing and calling me. But the officer came up to me within 1 minute and asked me, you know, what had happened, and I told him. And then he gave me a card and said, you know, give this to your insurance. Go on this website. And basically what happened was I read the report. It was probably about, I don't know, 4 sentences long, if that.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. We can't get too much into your particular story there. That said, Calvin, how do you train officers to deal with this is a very difficult situation. People are possibly injured, at the very least shaken up in a situation like this. What do you tell people who might be responding to that accident?
Well, from a training standpoint, number one, we want to make sure that the safety of the scene and the safety of everyone there is secure first. Secondly, we want to ensure that when we contact people, we are always fair and impartial in regards to how we conduct investigations. We don't take sides. We take all of the facts as they're presented. We corroborate the statements with the evidence of the scene and with other witness statements. And from there, we make a decision based off of if there were law violations. So it's a very difficult job when you have two people kind of saying, contradicting the same things. But again, the evidence and independent witness statements really go into us making a good, sound decision in regards to violations of the law.
Jennifer, thanks for that call. Sorry you went through that accident. I hope you're doing okay now. Time for another caller. Joan is with us in Watertown. Joan, hi.
Hi. I just remember about 4 years ago, I think it was, in the Madison State Journal, there was an article. I wish I would have saved it because it talked all about how there was some kind of a police chief that came here from Canada, and he was spreading this idea around to the police forces across the nation about how the police should start being more forceful when, you know, in their strategy, that they should, it was sort of a shoot first, ask questions later kind of a strategy, or to shoot to kill. And I wish I would have saved that article.
Joan, thanks for the call. We just got a minute or so left. Different philosophies in policing. I'm not familiar with that particular one, Jim.
Nor am I. Someone who represents officers when they use force, the last thing we want is a policy that encourages them to use the most force. Officers need to use the force that's necessary given the circumstances and given their perceptions, as Calvin mentioned a few minutes ago.
Hey, Calvin, just 40 seconds or so, what would you say, as I asked the Madison Acting Police Chief, what would you say to that person thinking, maybe law enforcement, I don't know?
I would say to that person to please come out. If there's anything, if you have any questions, please contact me at Madison College. We're actually having a criminal justice career fair April 21st at Madison College. And come out. There'll be agencies from all over the state here to talk and to get resumes and really get a great opportunity to talk to people that are interested in it. So please come out. Please contact me. I can answer any questions, concerns, or comments that you have at any time. Thank you.
Calvin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jim, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and Calvin Barrett, a law enforcement instructor at Madison College. We also heard earlier from Madison Police Department Acting Chief Victor Wall. We talked to them today about questions of police officer recruitment and retention and how the public perceives and looks at police work. This comes from an audience question as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. Do you have a question about anything in Wisconsin, submit it to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll find out how corporations are trying to buy and own colors so you can't use them, possibly. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the World Health Organization says it isn't ready to call coronavirus a pandemic. We'll find out why and check out the latest news about the illness and the efforts to contain it. First, let's play a little game. I'll name a product you think about a color. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, maybe the orange of the package. UPS, the brown, of course. Home Depot, back to orange. That fiberglass insulation inside your walls, depending on the brand, might just be pink. Since 1985, dozens of companies have claimed ownership over certain colors and filed suit against competitors who attempt to use them. So can a corporation own a color? Our next guest tackles that question in a piece online for The Hustle. Zachary Crockett is a journalist who's written for publications including Vox, Time Magazine, Gizmodo, and others. He's done radio work for NPR's Marketplace. Zach, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I had not heard of this concept that one can own, in effect, can copyright, or not copyright, trademark a color. What got you started tackling this issue?
Yeah, it's kind of an astonishing thing that's really just emerged in the last 30 years. I was walking by a jewelry store during Christmas, and like many people, probably wondered about how Tiffany got control over these blue boxes that jewelry comes in. And it kind of sent me down a rabbit hole and discovered dozens of brands that have done this in recent years.
Now, without digging too deeply into the complexities of intellectual property, this goes under trademark law, not like the patent side of things or the copyright side of things. What does trademark law mean? What does it do?
Sure. So trademark law in the United States goes back, you know, more than 200 years. Typically, it's used to defend a logo or a slogan. So think, you know, Nike or the famous Golden Arches, and also something like Just Do It or I'm Loving It. But in recent years, the definition of a trademark has really been stretched by corporations. And, you know, now you're starting to see sounds and shapes and scents and, as fate has it, even colors being protected under trademarks by brands.
So what are the most famous brands where we might recognize that color and it turns out, yeah, in fact, they've trademarked that color?
So you've got – every time you see a brown truck, you know it's a UPS truck. Tiffany has the blue boxes for its jewelry. You have the famous canary yellow on the 3M Post-it notes. You have yellow on wiffle balls. You have orange on Fisker's scissors. You have the red soles on the high heels of Louboutin shoes. And you even have colleges trademarking colors. You have University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill has their Carolina blue trademarked. And the University of Texas at Austin has a burnt orange trademark as well.
What does this mean for the use of these colors? I guess if I wanted to create a line of scissors and I made them exactly that same orange, I could see where that might be in trouble. But how far beyond that do companies go to defend their trademarked color?
Well, most of the companies that have these trademarks have a lot of legal firepower. So they are known to come after you and defend these. The most infamous of these companies is T-Mobile. Looking into their history, going back at least 12 years, there's almost a dozen times where they sent threatening legal paperwork or even took companies to court over the use of magenta. T-Mobile has said in the past the most important element of their entire corporate identity is the color magenta. Their CEO dyes his hair magenta. He even has a magenta slow cooker in his house. I mean, he's made it his entire life revolve around this color. The company is very litigious when it comes to other companies using that specific color of magenta.
Talking to Zachary Crockett, his piece headlined, "Can a Corporation Own a Color?" And you give, Zach, an example on that magenta T-Mobile issue of a guy who started a company and put a website, and he wasn't starting a cell service sub-provider company, but they were really interested in what he had to do. What happened?
Sure. So last summer, a guy named Daniel Schreiber, the CEO of this small insurance startup called Lemonade, got a threatening letter in the mail from T-Mobile. And, he was a little confused because he had this insurance company and here he is getting this letter from this massive telecom company. He hadn't used the company's logo. He hadn't used the tagline. And then reading the letter, he started to notice that they were threatening him because he had used a similar color of magenta in a totally unrelated industry. And the reason this can happen is generally trademarks protect just that specific industry. So, looking at Tiffany's blue boxes, they obviously can't defend their color blue, for use on a computer or something. But T-Mobile is such a large company and they have their tentacles in so many different industries, including healthcare, that they really have a very broad application of being able to protect that color.
And this creeps into different industries and into different hues of magenta. It looks like in the piece, you have different color palettes that I guess are covered, not just their magenta, but neighboring magentas.
Yeah, it really is something. I mean, essentially any color that's close enough to their color. It doesn't even have to be the exact color. If it causes customer confusion, they have a right to defend it. So it could be a completely different shade of magenta. But if it's close enough under this theory called the shade confusion theory, they'll be able to actually defend it.
I love the shade confusion theory concept. Now, whether or not a court would agree with this may not matter, right? If I own a small insurance company and T-Mobile is suing me, they can spend a lot more in court than I can. Do we actually end up with legal conclusions on these claims?
Yes. So most of the time, a company like T-Mobile will go after smaller players who don't really have the resources to fight back. In Lemonade's case, they had to stop using the color magenta in Germany, where this trademark suit was filed. And they are currently fighting it. But the other thing is, even when companies own these trademarks, they're incredibly hard to defend. There's a story in recent years, General Mills has tried to trademark the color yellow for Cheerios. And they've gone to court numerous times, and the courts have found that they're not legally allowed to file a trademark for yellow. And the reason for that is, in order to file one of these trademarks, you need to prove secondary meaning. You need to prove that there is an inextricable link between that color and the brand. And in Cheerios' case, there's just way too many other cereals. There's like 23 other cereal brands that use the color yellow. So it's impossible to prove that when you see the color yellow, you're immediately going to associate it with Cheerios.
Now, here's one that struck me as a little weird. Prince, the late musician, and is associated with the color purple. His estate is trying to trademark purple, at least in certain situations. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's one I found kind of trawling through the trademark database. They are trying to file a trademark for the color purple specifically for use in live music venues. And that sounds like it could be a pretty broad application.
Yeah.
But, the specific shade of purple that they have trademarked is called Love Symbol Number 2. Very, very Princeian name. it's for the color that should be used on buildings that performances will be inside of. So the applications are very specific sometimes.
In our last half a minute, clearly somebody in the marketing department believes that color is really important to consumer impressions of a company and a brand.
Yes. So there actually is, there are some studies to corroborate this, but between 60 and 90% of a consumer's initial judgment of a product is based on color. And more than half of consumers say that the color of a packaging is an indicator of the quality of the product. So color is very important with branding, and businesses know this and protect it.
Zach, thanks a lot for joining us.
Of course. Thanks.
That's journalist Zachary Crockett. He wrote the piece, Can a Corporation Own a Color for the Hustle? Let's have Central Time copyright a color, or trademark, I'm sorry, a color. Though, I don't know, on the radio, I don't know if that'll really come through. We'll get back to you on that. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the spread of coronavirus and efforts to come up with a vaccine. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the state assembly passed legislation last week that would raise the smoking and vaping age in Wisconsin to 21. We'll look at what we know about the effects that could have on public health. Now, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is urging people to brace for a coronavirus outbreak inside the country. So far, 14 people who recently traveled to China have been diagnosed in the U.S. Another 39 Americans have been diagnosed outside of the U.S. Worldwide, there have been more than 80,000 confirmed cases in 37 countries, killing 2,700 people. The World Health Organization, though, says coronavirus is not currently a pandemic. Dr. Nancy Messonnier of the CDC says containment measures have worked so far, but as the disease spreads around the world, it's going to be harder and harder to keep it out.
Ultimately, we expect we will see community spread in this country. It's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more of a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness.
Messonnier also said disruptions to daily life could be, quote, severe. Richard Harris is NPR's science correspondent. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, big picture, why isn't the World Health Organization ready to call this coronavirus outbreak a pandemic?
Well, I think they are worried that that will create panic and unnecessary fear. They think hard about what word they want to use because they don't have much muscle other than persuasion. And if they tip things over the edge and say, you know, this is now a pandemic and there's still some slight possibility that we can avoid a real pandemic, they don't want to go there. So I think, you know, they're well aware that this is likely to be a pandemic down the road, but they don't want to jump the gun.
And this morning now, closer to home, the CDC says it's more when, not if. It's just a matter of time before we see this here in the U.S. What are we watching for here in the United States?
Yeah, I think what we're probably watching for is cases that pop up in completely unexpected places. I think the CDC has done a really good job with state health officials of identifying people who've come back from China and are showing symptoms, and they've done a great job of either isolating them if they're sick or quarantining them if they're not, and really preventing spread from those individuals. So that seems to be sewn up pretty well. I think what's going to happen is some odd traveler from some other part of the world is going to end up here, and we won't really be thinking about being really watchful about them. And that's where something could start. That's just a scenario. I don't know. But that seems to be as likely as anything.
It seems like there's a lot of good news, bad news here in some ways. You can get infected with this thing and never really feel it or have a very mild symptom. That's good for that person getting it. The bad side is that sounds like it makes it harder to stop the spread. Is that a particular problem with this illness?
that is certainly a complication. There's no doubt about it. More than 80% of people really get mild symptoms or less. They don't end up in the hospital for sure. And so that's good. And even people who end up hospitalized, a small percentage of them die. So we have to be grateful that it's not a terribly lethal disease. But at the same time, you're exactly right. If you have people who are just sniffling or coughing or wandering around and sneezing and spreading the virus, people may not recognize that as anything other than a day-to-day activity. It could as well be the flu or a cold or something like that. And it does make it a little bit harder to control the disease for sure.
One possible bit of good news, if I'm reading some of your reporting correctly, a key Chinese province seeing the level of cases kind of hitting a plateau. What's happening?
Yeah, it seems to be under pretty good control in China, as a matter of fact. The CDC and was on a WHO trip to China, and the head of that trip was actually waxing very excitedly mm-hmm. about how successful China has been. He came back just overnight to Switzerland with a message, China really had this incredible challenge, and they rose to it, and they really appear to have really beaten back this disease. And it's obviously not over in China, and there's a very real possibility it could have a resurgence of some sort. But he said they really figured it out. They've really been able to stop the incredible spread of this disease and the very rapid rise in cases. And so he says that's a message that the rest of the world should pay heed to and not sort of throw up their hands and say there's nothing left we can do. We're just going to have to wait for this disease to settle on the world and cope with it when we can. He's still trying to marshal the troops, hoping that that people can actually stop it. I think it's at this point that's a bit of a long shot, but it's worth doing. China started out in really bad straits before they really were able to get it under control. So that is encouraging, but it's also maybe or maybe not a really good model for what's going to happen in the rest of the world.
What kind of tactics are they pointing to in China that may have helped at this point slow the spread?
Well, I think what they focus on is making sure that people who are symptomatic get seen very quickly by doctors and diagnosed and isolated so that they're not spreading it to other people. I think the other major thing that China did was made a lot of people stay home. They closed work. They closed schools for a long time. They stopped gatherings and so on. And those all seem to be pretty successful measures. I think more controversial was their decision to shut down travel. The WHO is of the opinion that shutting down travel may slow things down a little bit, but actually it does a lot of harm at the same time. And they are not recommending travel bans. They say we still need commerce. Obviously, the world economy cares about commerce, but also commerce of goods so that medical supplies can continue to flow and so on. So China did some stuff that was sort of over the top, but a lot of the stuff that they did that was sort of just sort of standard good practice for public health really seems to have done the trick here. And they brought out just thousands and thousands of people, government workers, whose job this was not to do. They brought them out to do these contact tracings and all other things like that they were able to scale up really quickly to identify contacts of people who had been sick and to make sure that they get isolated and they're not spreading it along to other people.
Richard Harris is with us, science correspondent for NPR, looking at coronavirus around the world and the risk of it here in the United States. Richard, the CDC, speaking of those schools and workplaces, CDC saying, hey, employers, feel free to send your employees home. Let them go home when they're sick. Isolate them if you can't. Saying similar things to schools. This doesn't always work very well in American culture. People don't always have sick time to take off. We want to show how tough we are by showing up sick at work. Is this something that's going to translate into action here?
Well, that is a really big problem, I think. And I think you're right that people, if they don't have sick leave built up or if not available to them, people may just simply need the money so badly that they can't afford to stay home sick, even though they really ought to. And it's in the public interest for them to do so. So I think the way our society is structured is certainly not optimal for trying to control a disease like this. I mean, you've seen, I'm sure, around your place, I've seen around my place, people who come in and they're still snuffling and sneezing and maybe have a little flu-like symptoms, and they may go home for a day if we're lucky, but they come back and they're still only half better and so on. And everyone is, you know, it's partly the work ethic. People partly enjoy their work also, but it's also a sense that, you know, I just have to keep going. I have to keep going. And I think that that does work at cross purposes with trying to control this disease. It is so important for people who are actually contagious to not to spread it around. It's so commonsensical. Just stay home if you can. But we're not always structured to do that.
The dream with an illness like this is to have an effective and safe vaccine. What would it take to get that, and how long would it take to get something like that?
Well, I think a little bit of luck would definitely be involved in getting that. I think there are numerous scientific groups hard at work right now trying to pursue that. The White House last night announced that it was requesting another $2.5 billion in total to ramp up efforts, and that includes increasing funding for vaccine research. The NIH has already partnered with a commercial company to work on that, and there are a bunch of other people out there. So there are good ideas floating around out there. We've seen a really checkered history about vaccines. Some vaccines have worked really remarkably well, like the measles vaccine does a great job of protecting us from the measles. But an AIDS vaccine has eluded us since 1981, when HIV was first discovered. So it's a little bit of a crapshoot to know whether you're going to end up really with a successful vaccine. But if you can do it, obviously that's a huge, huge advantage in terms of controlling this down the road, because it's at least several months before they can even test it for safety in humans, and it will probably take at least a year or two to run the test to find out if they're really effective and to compare multiple different options to see which ones work better than others.
We've talked about China. We've talked about the U.S. some. Where in the world are we watching for this disease spreading right now?
Three of the big hotspots are in South Korea. There's a big burst of activity there, unfortunately, around a kind of a church that has sort of flown beneath the radar. It's a sort of an unorthodox church, if you pardon the expression. And the cases in South Korea have spread fairly alarmingly and fairly rapidly. And so I think that's part of the reason that there are economic jitters, because South Korea is such an important part of the economic picture for trade around the world. A second place is Italy, where there was an outbreak sort of in the area around Milan, and people don't really understand where that came from, and they don't exactly know how they're going to bring that under control. And that's raising a lot of concern within Europe about how to bring that to a close if they possibly can. And I think the third and scariest place, although this doesn't have so many cases, is out of Iran. And there are a number of cases and a surprisingly large proportion of deaths from that, which could mean that there's something weird going on with the disease there, or it could mean that there are a lot of undiagnosed cases in Iran. And unfortunately, people are traveling around throughout the Middle East and have been spreading it to Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East from Iran. And when you start to see this disease showing up in places that have public health resources that are not at the level that we have here in the United States or in Europe, that's where it can really get out of control. And so I think that there are a lot of cautious, worried people looking at Iran and saying, and now increasingly in the Middle East, wondering, is this where things are going to really start to take off and get and sort of escape even the best efforts to control the disease?
Richard, before I let you get back to your reporting, what are you watching for next?
Well, it's a story that has a lot of twists and turns. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to anticipate what the future will bring. Obviously, I just alluded to some of these international trends that I think will say a lot about how rapidly this disease spreads around the world. And so that's a key question. I'm also interested in understanding how quickly we can set up better testing in this country, both for just identifying people who have flu-like symptoms to see if they actually have coronavirus. It's a way of trying to really understand if there's sort of hidden infections in this country that we don't know about yet. That's a possibility, and the CDC is just setting up that testing scheme right now, so it'll take a little while to get results from that, but I think that's an important part of surveillance in this country. And I'm also interested in understanding to what extent there are silent infections, or people who got sick and got better and never even knew it, and that takes a special blood test that is just under development right now to ferret that out. But I think there's going to be some really interesting revelations about the natural history of this disease that await just a little bit more testing and a little bit more scientific information. So being a science reporter, that, of course, draws my attention and my interest.
Richard, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Richard Harris is NPR's science correspondent. We talked to him about the global spread of coronavirus. The World Health Organization is not calling the outbreak a pandemic, at least not yet. And here in the U.S., the CDC says it's probably just a matter of time before the disease spreads at a community level inside the U.S. You can keep following reporting on the coronavirus over at NPR.org. Here's a gift you didn't know you needed and probably don't actually need. A McDonald's fan club website, there is such a thing, sells merchandise, including this set of six candles representing the flavors in a Big Mac, one each for bun, ketchup, pickle, cheese, onion, and of course, beef. Well, that got us looking around for other food-themed candles. Producer Rachel Vasquez, hey.
Hey.
So you guys found this one.
Yes. So it's a crazy story. Apparently in the 1960s, Big Mayonnaise was pushing mayonnaise in candles.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You combine cranberry sauce with candles and you stick a wick in it and light her up.
Yeah, I took a look at the story you shared and it's even weirder than that because it's actually... You make it at home. It's an edible candle.
Yeah.
That you're going to serve with cranberry and, yeah, walnuts. And, yeah. So you're making this at home, I'm assuming?
Well, I feel like I was lied to a little bit because I thought it was an only mayonnaise candle, which okay. I'm interested in.
So you would be up for something that shares the sweet, sweet smell of mayonnaise
yeah. In
smoke form?
Mayonnaise is good everywhere. Candle form, on your burger. It's on your breakfast burrito?
Yeah, but I mean, a tangy smell to suffuse your house
yeah.
with mayonnaise. You'd be cool with that.
With a bubble bath going. I think it sounds so nice.
Huh. Okay, well, I hope to see it at the office sometime soon. I don't think we're allowed to have open flame, though, so that's a downside.
True. Yeah.
We'll just leave open jars of mayonnaise out in the sun. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.